Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Healthcare to the climax this week. Democrats pushing, Republicans hollering, and a top general testifies on the price of no peace in the Middle East. Health reform came one vote closer when Ohio holdout Dennis Kucinich said he's ready to vote yes.
If my vote is to be counted, let it count now for passage of the bill, hopefully in the direction of comprehensive health care reform.
Fighting to the end, Texas Republican Louie Gohmert slammed the 2,700-page health bill on the floor of the House.
This should not be passed by anyone unless they eat it. If they eat it, then I'm in favor of them passing it. Otherwise, don't pass it.
And in the midst of high U.S.-Israel tension, General David Petraeus told the Senate the unsolved Israel-Palestinian standoff is hitting the U.S. military.
The tensions, the issues, and so forth have an enormous effect. They set the strategic context within which we operate.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Is health reform happening? Should it? And what about the jobs bill? No child left behind, the U.S. and Israel. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Eleanor Clift, contributing editor and columnist for Newsweek. Eleanor Clift, welcome back to On Point.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
Also from Washington, we're joined by Noam Levy. He's health policy reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Noam, great to have you with us as well.
Hi, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Eleanor, and Noam.
All right, Noam, you're the man of the hour. I guess the first thing is the vote count. We've got a lot to talk about on health, but how does it look? They need 216. What do they have as of this moment?
Well, most estimates have them within five or six votes of that, maybe even closer. There's, as you mentioned in your lead-in, there's an awful lot of discussions going on, cajoling, convincing, arm-twisting, et cetera. It's going to be all Democrats, as you noted. And Nancy Pelosi and her lieutenants are working hard to keep the majority that they had last year when they passed a slightly different bill and also potentially pick off a few no votes who voted against it last year.
We'll look at what it's taking and may still take to get those 216 votes in line in the House. But Noam, remind us, because it's hard to keep this clearly in mind for those of us who aren't, you know, parliamentarians, deem and this and that. What's the process that's going the Democrats hope unfolds this weekend and then in the days following?
Well, in broad outlines, bear in mind that the Senate passed a health care bill last December, right before Christmas.
Right.
The House has to pass that bill in order for it to become law. And because Democrats don't have a 60-vote supermajority in the Senate any longer, they can no longer cut off filibusters.
Mm-hmm.
So they feel that the only way that they can actually get a health care bill to the president's desk would be for the House to approve the Senate bill.
Okay.
And then for both chambers to approve a package of changes to that Senate bill to address concerns that House Democrats and others have with the way the Senate bill was structured.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean in terms of a sequence of votes?
Yep.
The first vote will probably be this weekend, Sunday. The House will take two votes. One vote will be a procedural vote, which will, in effect, pass the Senate health care bill.
This is the so-called deem and pass procedure, and why, if I'm right, and why are they doing that instead of just voting on it straight up?
Well, there was a lot of concern among rank-and-file Democrats about voting for the Senate health care bill by itself. There are provisions in there which have gotten a lot of attention, like the special deals for Nebraska, the so-called Cornhusker kickback. There is a big new tax on high-end Cadillac health plans that a lot of organized labor and rank-and-file Democrats don't like. They don't want to vote for that.
So, Noam, these are things that would go away under the Democrats' plan, but if they had to have a straight-up vote on it, they would be on the record, if only for a couple of days, as having supported that, or 5 minutes, and that would be brought out on the stump. But what's the deem and pass will effectively do the same thing, right? Deem it to be passed.
it will effectively do the same thing. And I don't think anybody at this point is under any illusion that if a Democrat votes for this procedural motion, that he or she won't be open to criticism, praise, whatever, that they're on record backing the Senate bill.
So that's so, Sunday, and what else?
That's Sunday. As soon as that procedural vote is taken, the House will proceed directly to a vote on it, on this package of changes, which I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
These are, just very briefly, these would scale back that Cadillac tax I mentioned. They would boost subsidies available for low and moderate income Americans to help them buy health insurance in this new, these
mandated
new insurance exchanges.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Provide additional help to states to help them expand Medicaid. That package would be approved by the House on Sunday. The president will likely sign the Senate health care bill. Then the action shifts over to the Senate. Now, the Senate, I mentioned earlier, Democrats don't have a 60-vote supermajority
mm-hmm.
anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But they're going to proceed under another procedure called budget reconciliation. Under that procedure, bills that deal with the budget can be passed with a simple 51-vote majority.
Right.
This package of fixes to the Senate bill that passes the House this weekend could therefore be advanced, Democrats believe, under this reconciliation package process. So next week, the Senate will begin debating this package and trying to push it through by the end of the week so that everybody can go home for Easter and Passover.
So who knows? But if it goes according to the Democrats' hope and plan at this point, by the end of next week, the Senate passes it, the president presumably signs it immediately, and the reform is law. Before the Easter holidays?
That's right.
Passover? Mm-hmm. Well, Eleanor Clift, is that what you see coming, madam?
Yes. And rarely does the media and the country pay such close attention to the sausage making.
No kidding, but here it is.
Right. And the opponents of the health care bill have made it seem as though this is highly unusual, perhaps even unconstitutional. With a little research, you can discover that both parties have used these procedures. They're almost what you would call routine. And it's the only path left to the Democrats if they want to turn this legislation into law. And I think the Democrats are feeling that they just have to go ahead and do it, let everybody hold their noses, and then once the package is in place, they can begin to convince the American people that indeed there are benefits in this package for them individually, for society as a whole, and in extending health care coverage to 32 million more people. And the numbers that the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan office,
mm-hmm.
Produced earlier this week, saying that this bill would actually reduce the deficit over the long run. In the first 10 years, I think it's by $138 billion, and then $1.3 trillion mm-hmm. in the second 10 years after the bill is in effect. That's the best news that the Democrats have had in a long time, and I think that reassures some of the more conservative Democrats in the House, the so-called blue dogs,
mm-hmm.
That they can vote for this in the teeth of what looks like a real backlash about the mounting deficit, backlash that's growing across the country. Mm-hmm. So that was helpful. But there's going to be a lot of salesmanship over the next 8 months on the part of Democrats, and Republicans are pledging to campaign for the fall
straight
elections
against
on
it.
A pledge to repeal the legislation.
So a lot of explaining over the next 8 days and the politicking the next 8 months. Jack, I want to get to you, but Noam, help us if you would just for a second. We're going to spend 900 and something billion, nearly $1 trillion on this plan, but it's going to be a net benefit, the CBO says, a net reduction in deficit by 130 some billion and then nearly $1 trillion. Where does the gain in the deficit come if it's got spending attached to it?
Well, this is actually an unusual piece of social legislation in the sense that it actually would reduce the deficit, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Just by way of a little historical perspective, when Congress enacted the Medicare drug benefit in 2003, there was not even a pretense of trying to offset the costs of that benefit. So how does that happen? Well, two major sources of income. One is a series of cuts in what Medicare will pay to private insurance companies, hospitals, other providers over the next 10, 20 years. The other are a series of new taxes. I mentioned earlier the Cadillac tax. There are fees and taxes on medical device makers, on pharmaceutical companies, and there'll be a new Medicare tax on higher income households on their investment income, those making more than, for couples, more than $250,000 a year.
So a trillion out to bring in the reforms, Jack, but over by 2029, nearly a trillion, gain in the deficit picture. I'm sorry, Jack, we've just got a minute here before the break, but what do you see unfolding this weekend and in the days ahead, Jack?
I have no idea. I mean, I just don't know. I see in today's paper, the Congressman Kucinich is on board. Yes, Congressman Gutierrez of Chicago is on board. But Stephen Lynch and a congressman from Boston and a congressman from New York State are off. So I just don't know. I don't think anybody knows. It's interesting in today's Times, one of the reports sort of said that the Republicans assume it's going to pass, which it's hard to see that in the numbers. I'm heartened because I do want to see the bill pass. There are 32 million good reasons for that. But,
that is people who would be covered.
People who would be covered, yeah. But Nate Silver, the mathematical prodigy who runs a website, he's done his algebra and so on, and he thinks, yep, it'll pass.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news this hour. Healthcare on the brink. A jobs bill, Wall Street regs, U.S.-Israel tensions. Noam Levy is with us from the Los Angeles Times, health policy reporter there. Eleanor Clift is here from Newsweek. Jack Beatty's here. We hear Dennis Kucinich. Of course, he was against. Now he's for, but it's not exactly a ringing endorsement. Here he is announcing in a Wednesday press conference that he was changing his mind and would vote for the health care reform bill.
I have doubts about the bill. I do not think it is a step toward anything I've supported in the past. This is not the bill I wanted to support, even as I continue efforts until the last minute to try to modify the bill. However, after careful discussions with President Obama, Speaker Pelosi, my wife Elizabeth, and close friends, I've decided to cast a vote in favor of the legislation.
Eleanor Clift, that's a gigantic however from Dennis Kucinich there. You know, he has his doubts. It doesn't do this that he wants. It doesn't do that that he wants. But I've heard the interpretation that he's voting yes because he's been told the Obama presidency is on the line.
Well, and the president went into his district in Strongsville, Ohio. I think that's where Superman is from. And among his constituents is a woman who had written a letter to the White House, and the president reads 10 letters every day of the thousands he received. And this woman described how she had had cancer a decade ago. She had survived, but because of that, the insurance company kept raising her rates to the point where she could no longer afford the premiums. So she dropped her insurance coverage, and this was the letter that she wrote the president. And he responded. He read her letter to an insurance company executive, and then in recent weeks, she gets diagnosed with leukemia. She's now in the hospital, the Cleveland Clinic, without insurance. And so her sister introduced the president at the rally. It doesn't get much more emotional than that. The woman from her sick bed tells Dennis Kucinich, as her representative, she would like him to vote for this bill. It's a good start. And Kucinich had to add all those doubts because he was so firmly on the other side. But I don't think there was ever any real doubt that he would walk away from this. He doesn't want to be the Ralph Nader of the new Ralph Nader of the Democratic Party if he were the vote that denied this plan from passing.
It was affecting the 50-year-old cancer patient on TV screens all over the country in the hospital bed without health insurance because of high premiums. After that meeting in Ohio, we saw ABC's Jake Tapper asking the president, though, exactly how the health care bill would benefit Natoma Canfield.
First of all, what would the bill do for Natoma?
Well, what would have happened is Natoma would have been able to be part of this exchange, this marketplace, that gave her a choice of plans, just like members of Congress have, but because she'd be a part of a million people who are in a pool, her rates would be lowered. And so you wouldn't have seen her being put in the choice of where she's got to choose between her house or her health care. And that's true for self-employed, for small businesses, for individuals all across the country.
Jack Beatty, is this package going to save Natomas across the country?
Well, I think that takes a leap of faith. Essentially, Natoma would be, and the 10% of Americans who would get insured under these exchanges would be in the Swiss system. That's the system they have in Switzerland. There's a private market of insurance. Everyone is required to buy it. But the Swiss have a stipulation, and the stipulation is that the companies from which they buy the insurance have to be nonprofit. And they have to put their profits back into lowering premiums for the next year. There's competition among companies for various packages and so on. But the basic package, it's a nonprofit system. The profit motive is still central to our system. And the incentive to take people off, to rescissions, to take coverage away from people, to eliminate, that's supposed to be eliminated now, but we just don't know. And in the Swiss system, the entire country is the buying, has the fulcrum of that kind of power to buy. Here it'll only be select groups within states. Will that be enough to get rates down? We don't know. And then all of these insurance markets, I think something like 80% of insurance markets fit the Justice Department definition of a concentrated market, a market where there's near monopoly power. Is that going to change? This question, I think, is an imponderable. If we had had single payer, Medicare for all, he could have said, yes, this woman would be covered. That would be a guarantee. There's no such guarantee now.
Noam Levy, Natoma's case is very affecting. You see her there in the hospital bed, but what about it? Would this package help people like her, or is it, as Jack says, a leap of faith?
Well, I think one thing one can say is that almost certainly she would be able to get, that she would have more access to coverage. The question, of course, which Jack raises is entirely correct, which is what price will it be? And, it's interesting Jack talks about the Swiss system. One of the things that Switzerland does, in addition to the things that Jack mentioned, is highly regulates the price of medical care. So all insurers in Switzerland are paying doctors and hospitals the same price. It will be the equivalent of Blue Cross, say, or Anthem.
But that's not Humana. What's coming here.
No, it is not what's coming here. And that's one of the ways that the Swiss system imposes more price discipline. I don't think we live in a country yet that's ready to do that level of regulation. So the hope is that, once there is additional regulation of the insurance industry itself, that can help rationalize a market, which is right now a bit like the Wild West. And there is a provision in the Senate bill that would give additional authority to the government to begin regulating premiums in the same way that some states regulate home insurance or auto insurance, as a way to force insurance companies to justify what they're charging. But I just say one thing really, really quickly is that in the insurance industry always claims that they are not the reason for the high prices of their premiums, that in fact the hospitals are charging a lot. People are using a lot of medicine. That is also true. They may be the bad guys here, but there's a lot of blame to go around.
Let's go to Ike in Charleston, South Carolina. Ike, you're on the air.
Yeah, let me see if I can make good use of this couple minutes I've got here. My message to the elites, and particularly the Democratic Party, you failed. You had the majority. You should have pushed through what we wanted. What we want is we want the money changers thrown out of the temple. We want public option. We want some real power to bear on these insurance companies and the things that they do to us. And in a further note, I'll put it to you this way. You know, I'm a 50-year-old ex-construction worker because I speak English. Now you're going to have a march on D.C. here on the 23rd of illegals. You're going to bring them into the market as well. You know what? You can't run a great country on $8 an hour, $10 an hour, no benefits, and no way to provide. And that's exactly the pressure you put us under. And there's a lot of us folks out here on the bottom end that, you know what? You got two choices. You either do something or you're going to pay for it anyway. Because I got news for you. When I get sick, I'm going to the hospital. So you've got no choice. The only choice that you have is, and by the way, shame on the United States that the rest of the industrialized countries can provide for their people a decent standard of living and access to health care, and we're sitting here quibbling. The Democrats should have taken care of this, and I am not happy with this compromise bill. They should have bit the bullet and went through and done their job.
Ike, we hear it loud and clear. Do you vote yay or nay on the package that's there now?
You have to vote yay, but the fact is they're giving us half a loaf. They should have went public option, and they should have, the same way they are, man.
Not a happy yay. We got it. We've got it loud and clear, Ike, and I appreciate your call. Let's get one more right here from North Carolina. Charlotte, John, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Tom. I wanted to comment. I thought I'd heard in Fortune magazine that the cuts in Medicare, and this was from Paul Ryan in Wisconsin, were going to be rescinded in another bill. So there are no real cuts to begin with.
And these would be the cuts that would help reduce the deficit by the CBO numbers over time. You're skeptical, John?
I'm skeptical on that.
Noam Levy, what can you tell us about that? And also respond to Ike's, you hear Ike's fury there in South Carolina, working man who doesn't like what's happened with the economy, doesn't feel like his back has been covered by the Democratic Party.
Well, really quickly on the Medicare cuts. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, they're targeted at a number of different areas. One would be, I mentioned, private insurance companies that contract with the federal government to provide what's called Medicare Advantage plans to millions of senior citizens around the country. Those are in the bill. They will remain in the bill. They're probably going to go forward. The cuts to providers like hospitals, nursing homes, et cetera, are designed to do a couple of different things, among which would be to encourage those providers to be more efficient over time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those are cuts that will be subject to political debate going forward. So there is some skepticism, particularly on the right, that Congress will have the fortitude to follow through with those cuts going forward.
Norm, weren't there Medicare cuts that were just turned around within the last couple of months, if I recall correctly?
You're correct. The classic example is what's called the sustainable growth rate formula for physicians. Medicare, 10 years ago, more than a decade ago, lawmakers and the Clinton administration worked out a formula to try to restrain how much the federal government was paying physicians. Was always very unpopular. Congress kept putting it off and putting it off and putting it off to the point where every year, in order to get back to that formula, the cut had to be bigger and bigger. It became more and more politically unpalatable, and it essentially now is going to be thrown out because nobody has the courage to tell doctors you're going to get a 25% cut in what you're paid when a senior citizen comes to see you.
Eleanor, do you see hocus pocus in the CBO budget numbers or real savings over time?
I think it's very hard to project this far out with a complicated bill, but I think these are legitimate numbers, and I think they put in place a structure for the delivery of health care that has a better chance of controlling costs in the future. And to the caller who would have liked a more ambitious bill, a lot of the negative numbers in the polls about the bill include people like him who think it should go further. But the political system, this was what it was able to cough up at the end of a year with a lot of difficulty. And the reasons the Democrats are in the majority is that they've got people like Ben Nelson from conservative states, and you can't get everybody to agree on a more far-reaching effort. I think one of the most absurd provisions in the Senate bill is a ban on having illegal immigrants buy health insurance with their own money, because then they will go to the emergency room and our laws are humane and we say, yes, they will be treated. And it's not at all cost effective. But those are the kinds of political trade-offs that have had to be made in order to get the Ben Nelsons of the world and other more conservative members of the Congress.
It is big, messy business. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jack, what do you say to Ike and his anger about the health care bill and about the whole economy, maybe including some of those illegal immigrants that are being denied the power to buy it here? He's going to end up in the emergency room right next to them, he warns us.
It certainly sounds that way. You know, relative to his question about the public option and even beyond that, single payer, you almost wonder, wouldn't the Democrats have been just as well to go in that direction? I mean, Republican Billingsgate now is all the time socialism. I've watched these debates this week in the Budget Committee and elsewhere. It's socialism. It's a government takeover of health care. It's 1/6 of the economy. It's none of those things. I don't think these Republican representatives can really believe that. They're too intelligent, but they want to scare their base, and this is the way they do it. But you wonder, if the Democrats are called socialists for essentially reforming the insurance market and helping people who can't afford it with subsidies, something that supermajorities of the public favor, why shouldn't they have gone the whole way and gone towards something that would, you know, okay, it's Medicare for all, be a real socialist.
Maybe. Des Moines, Iowa. Joe, you're on the air, Joe.
Hi, Tom. Do you know why jobs are so hard to get in the pharmaceutical and medical equipment sales fields?
You tell us, Joe.
Because doctors are bailing out of the profession right and left and taking these jobs. How do you expect a young man to give 12 years of his life to become a doctor for the prospect of being told when he's going to get paid, what is he going to get paid?
So how does that bear on where you'd vote on the reform package, Joe?
Well, after what this guy said, I guess I'm going to sound like one of those extreme teabaggers that are demonized and vilified and stupefied by the press.
Let's hear it. Let's hear it.
I'm scared. I'm scared, buddy. I don't want it. I don't want it. Ayoko Ayomo, that's Tagalog for I don't like, I don't want.
You don't want the reform, but why not, Joe?
Because I've never had an enjoyable experience with a government office dealing yet. And when they say drop your drawers and cough, I don't want it to be somebody from the government holding my testicles they might not let go.
I don't think it goes quite there. Noam Levy, government takeover of health care, is that justified by the facts in the bill?
No, it's not a government takeover, but I think there is one thing that is true in the critique. I mean, the bill unquestionably expands the government's role in the healthcare sector by increasing regulation of particularly the insurance industry. If you believe that that's something that's necessary, presumably you're going to support the bill. If you don't, then you're going to have problems with it. I should add one thing, which is, I think, something of an irony that's lost in some of this debate about government health care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 50 cents of every dollar spent on health care in the United States, which is now approaching $2.5 trillion a year, is spent by the government, the federal government and state government. So we have a system that is remarkably controlled by the government already.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody who's over... who's retired in this country on Medicare gets their health care from the government. We were talking about Switzerland earlier.
Including Tea Party members.
and Switzerland, a system was highly regulated, I think 20 cents of every dollar is spent by the government. So sometimes things don't exactly comport to the way people think about them. But just to get back to your caller's point, he is correct that the government will be playing more of a role in healthcare. They won't be holding his hand probably when he's in there in the examining room, but they will be looking over what his insurance company is charging him.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. In other news this week, Fargo, North Dakota on high alert as the Red River goes way high. David Johnson is building dikes and levees.
It's a long, hard day, but we just keep going. Got to save our city, you know.
College basketball's March Madness kicked off yesterday with the requisite opening round upset as 13th-seeded Murray State knocked off 4th-seeded Vanderbilt.
Got it at the buzzer! And 13-seeded Murray State has pulled off the opening round shocker!
There you go. And actor Peter Graves, dead at 83, as Jim Phelps of Mission Impossible. He got a taped message each week with his mission if he chose to accept it.
As always, should you or any member of your IM force be caught or killed, the Secretary will disavow any knowledge of your actions. This tape will self-destruct in 5 seconds. Good luck, Jim.
Eleanor Clift is with us from Newsweek this hour. Noam Levy from the Los Angeles Times and our own Jack Beatty. Let's go to Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. On Wednesday, President Obama sat down for an interview with Bret Baier of Fox News, who repeatedly interrupted him and showed no respect for him as he had when he interviewed George Bush in 2008. Eleanor Clift's magazine, Newsweek, called it the Interruptathon. I think that's right. And earlier this week, on Sunday, Hal Raines, former editor of the New York Times, wrote an op-ed about Fox, and he said, for the first time since the days of yellow journalism, the U.S. has a major news organization devoted to the promotion of one political party. And he asked, why don't honest journalists take on Roger Ailes and Fox News? And his conclusion was, because with the collapse of newspapers and declining market shares, the journalists see Fox as a prospective employer.
Mm-hmm.
So my question to your panel is, do you agree with Howell Raines about Fox News being a propaganda outlet? And if so, why do you think that lots of people who know better are keeping quiet about what to call it?
Mark, I promise we'll take that question straight up. Let's listen to just a little bit of the interview that you cite. I don't know if this is the fiercest part, and I'm not throwing stones here. Sometimes interviewers should be aggressive, but Fox's Bret Baier was really all over the President of the United States. It is true. The President finally got frustrated at the interruptions. You can hear a little bit of the back and forth right here.
I don't spend a lot of time worrying about what the procedural rules are in the House or the Senate. What I can tell you is that the vote that's taken in the House will be a vote for health care reform. And if people vote yes, whatever form that takes, that is going to be a vote for health care reform. And I don't think we should pretend otherwise.
But, Mr.
And
President, Monday...
Brett, let me finish. And if they don't, if they vote against it, then they're going to be voting against health care reform, and they're going to be voting in favor of the status quo.
Just a little bit of the Fox interviewer getting way deep in the president's face there. Eleanor, Noam, Jack, let's take a poll right here on the issue of Fox News and Roger Ailes. Howell Raines, formerly the New York Times, says it's propaganda, and why don't mainstream journalists say so if it's their job to call things like they are? Eleanor, what about it? News outlet or propaganda outlet, or what do you say?
Well, it's intensely a political network, but they haven't gone over any line because there's no line that anybody has drawn as far as I can see. And in terms of mainstream journalists not standing up to Fox, I suspect journalists who are on the right side of the ideological spectrum find it a welcome place to be. And I don't think there are a whole lot of liberals that are thinking they're going to have a broadcast future at Fox. So I think the argument that it's a prospective place of employment is not a good one to
make.
Well,
but of course, Murdoch owns Fox. Murdoch now owns the Wall Street Journal. I've got a lot of journalist friends who are now working for Rupert Murdoch. But Jack, what about it? No line between news and propaganda?
Well, we have to believe there is a line, and I don't watch Fox, so I don't know what to say about that. I do watch Jon Stewart's parodies and send-ups of some of its buffoonish characters, Glenn Beck notably, and he seems to me to be a kind of, as I say, a buffoon. If you watch him and you believe that sort of thing, then you're terminally credulous, it seems to me, because he's so patently a throwback to an American archetype, the snake oil salesman, the entertainer. So I think they are over the line. What I note, though, is how that the pressure that puts on Republican politicians, that I do observe. And just consistently, they say things that can't be squared with reality. As, for example, about this bill, government takeover of health care. You know, why are they saying that? Other than the climate of opinion is such that if you're a Republican, you daren't say anything else. And the reason for that climate opinion, one of them seems to be the hold of Fox News on core Republican voters.
Noam Levy, I don't know if any journalist wants this question, but Fox News or propaganda, Noam?
Well, I don't know that I'm qualified to answer that question. I mean, you know, I got my hands full here trying to figure out what's going on with healthcare without keeping track of what is done on cable news.
You're a working man, and we respect that. Can we look at the jobs bill for a second? This is about what, some more billions in stimulus, and here's President Obama. He says he's thanking the GOP on this one because there were some Republican votes for reaching across the aisle to join in the $18 billion bill. Here he is in the Rose Garden signing on Thursday morning.
I hope this is a prelude to further cooperation in the days and months to come as we continue to work on digging our way out of the recession and rebuilding our economy in a way that works for all Americans and not just some Americans.
Works for all Americans, said the president. And he had a dozen or so Republican votes there, but New Hampshire Republican Judd Gregg on the Senate floor Wednesday urged colleagues to vote against the bill, ultimately passed. But you hear what Gregg thought of it.
This isn't so much a jobs bill as it is a debt bill. It adds to debt, debt, and debt.
Noam, do you know how the Democrats got that, 11 or 12 Republican votes on board with the jobs bill here?
Well, there were a lot of things in this jobs bill that were that had a lot of bipartisan support. I mentioned we were talking earlier about the ensuring that doctors who treat Medicare patients get enough money. That was in there. There were some tax breaks in there for businesses that hire people. These are the kinds of things that are hard to vote against.
Eleanor, were you surprised?
Right.
Is this a little thin dawn of something different or not?
Well, Scott Brown, the new Republican from Massachusetts, mm-hmm. was one of the first in his party to break to support this bill because he wants to get reelected in 3 years. He's up again, and he's going to have to cross the political aisle and side with the Democrats on some on bills. And Noam is right. There were provisions in this bill that Republicans love. It was tax breaks, and it's the first of what the White House hopes will be a series of jobs bills so that this Congress looks at least like they're trying to get at the stubborn unemployment in this country and do things that will create jobs. And listening to Senator Gregg, I'm amazed when I recall that the president tried to get him to serve as his Commerce Secretary. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine that would have been a very good fit.
Might have been a little ugly. Jack, here's right. $18 or $20 billion more for jobs and tax breaks to create jobs. But boy, they've been slow in coming. I mean, huge unemployment in this country still.
Huge. And there's no evidence that's going to change anytime soon. In fact, testimony this week from the administration's own economic team basically saying that we're looking at high 9, perhaps even 10% unemployment through the year, which is a tragedy for the unemployed and a potential disaster for the Democratic Party in the fall. You know, on this jobs bill, I note economists looking at it say it looks as if the tax breaks, the inducements for businesses to hire people, that a lot of this is just going to go to businesses who would have hired people anyway. And they point to the hospitality industry, to the seasonal hiring that restaurants do in the summer and vacation areas and so on. And I'm afraid that's the look of this to me, too.
Is Judd Gregg right, then? It's just as to the debt. If the jobs would have been there anyway, why spend the money?
You have to wonder about that. Now, as Noam said, there are other things in there. There are billions for public works and so on. That's
highway construction.
Yeah, yeah. But this notion that it's going to that the 250,000 jobs estimated to be created, how many of those would have been created anyway? We just don't know.
Davenport, Iowa. Terry, you're on the air.
Tom and Eleanor, I just wanted to comment on the Fox situation.
Okay.
I think that you can be very mediocre intellectually and tell very clearly that they are biased politically. And furthermore, I think it's exacerbated by the racism that was inherent in the disrespect shown the president. And talk about a good example of how we need to attenuate this kind of thing and promote civility.
Right there in the interview with Brett Baer, you say, Terry, we've got it. Let's get Dave in Des Moines. Dave, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, Kuhnian notion of paradigms. You say it enough, even if it's not true, and they believe it. That's what Bernays did in the 20s, and that's what the Nazis figured out, and Fox is doing the same thing.
The father of public relations and on. Yeah, so that's all you see there?
That's all I see there, and the fact that a journalist can say, well, it's just another opinion. It's not another opinion. It's untruth, just like there were WMDs, just like there were anything. We have to push back, or we're going to lose our country, Tom. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Dave. People still on the Fox front there. Let's get Sylvia in Burlington, Vermont. Sylvia, you're on the air.
Thanks. You know, the Republicans are infuriating. When you consider that they are sitting in the perfect seat, they're completely covered for every medical problem that you could possibly have.
You mean the members of Congress and their coverage there? Okay, yeah.
But they're so anti-government, they forget they are the government.
Well, if they're elected,
they are the government. How can they be so anti-government when they are the government? It's completely baffling to me.
Sylvia, we've got it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Eleanor, we hear Sylvia, and yet there are people out there who do look at our fiscal future and worry that the government has become just too big.
Well, there are legitimate concerns about the debt that we're piling up. It is unsustainable, but in the short term, it is necessary spending. And my only beef with the administration is that they didn't spend enough. I mean, this is Keynesian economic policy to get us out of the ditch caused by the economic meltdown. And I think that the president and politicians haven't distinguished between the short-term necessary spending and the long-term structural debt that we do have to address. And the Tea Party movement has grown up around this by conflating all the debt together and making it seem as though President Obama is responsible for all of it and taking us over some socialist cliff. I think the president has done a better job in really since the State of the Union in pushing back. I think he didn't take a lot of the cries of socialism seriously enough when they first surfaced last summer. And he had the kind of naive notion that if he just acted rationally, that his good deeds would speak for themselves. And I think he's learned he's got to sell and muscle through everything he does. And that's one of the reasons he's still in town trying to get this health care bill through.
And not in Indonesia. Wendy in Nashville. Wendy, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm sorry that you guys have kind of moved on to the jobs bill, but I was calling mainly just out of frustration for everybody kind of railing against Fox News.
What's your view, Wendy? Let's hear it.
Well, I do think that most news broadcasts today are opinion-based, and I think that it's definitely a nice balance to CNN, certainly to MSNBC, which is not even watchable, in my opinion. I don't know. It just seems kind of unfair.
Wendy, we hear you, and I thank you for your call. Jack, I mean, you know, it is interesting. You get out of an era of what was supposed to be straight-up news. You get into an era of a lot of opinion in the news, and pretty soon you can understand if a lot of Americans look and say, well, we've passed some tipping point. It's all opinion anyway. But then what do you do if there's no objective source of news or as close to it as we can manage, Jack?
Yeah, you know, it's at once a return to an earlier generation of yellow journalism and of even more than that, of political journalism. That was the 19th century. There were Democratic papers, Republican papers. Pulitzer and others in the 20th century, the innovation was to have, how about just the news? How about just, you know, all the news that's fit to print? That objectivity was a triumph, or the attempt at it, over that political journalism. Now we're back to that on the tube to essentially political journalism. And what happens is that the facts go away. There are no facts. It's like and here it's almost like a postmodern situation. What facts? It's your construction of the facts. It's my liberal spin on the facts. And you're in a world where you can't talk to someone on the other side because you can't agree even upon the, well, is the earth flat or round? Well, that depends how you construe it. And I think this is a very, very serious problem. I mean, when I see Paul Krugman writing something in the New York Times saying, practically, he said something like, Republicans are a different species, or it said something like that. He was trying to say, the way the Republicans were talking about these bills was just too preposterous. And he said, well, they're another species, practically words to that effect. Well, I think that's that there's a kind of dead end there for democracy. We've got to be able to talk, and we've got to be able to agree on the world, on the facts.
If you're invested in a pluralistic democracy, I think the facts matter. Noam Levy, I'm glad you're in there. At least let's, on the health front, sort of following this step by step by step. Any news as we've been talking, Noam? You must be checking your BlackBerry and keeping a weather eye out there. Are we still? Is it still 5 or 6 votes that needed for this thing?
Things are actually moving as we speak. People are coming on both sides. Actually, you know, I let me just say something really quickly about what Jack was saying. It's interesting that you know, that there is this criticism, this question of what kind of a media institution can actually can be an honest arbiter of what is actually true. We had a lot of problem earlier this year dealing with the charges that there were death panels in the health care bill, something that was patently false. And, you know, a lot of the old line media institutions like the LA Times, the New York Times, the Washington Post, we tried to come up with ways to counter that. But, you know, there is so many media outlets and rumors and misinformation get spread. It's very hard.
Americans, hang on to facts. They come in useful and they come back around to bite. Noam Levy with the LA Times. You're great, and we appreciate your time today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Eleanor Clift at Newsweek, always wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
And thanks to you, Jack.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.